Thank you for that reading. It's amazing you can just read those same words that you've heard so many times and they come alive in a new way. Well, I am thrilled to be here this weekend and for a couple of different reasons. I mean, I love what I get to do and I'm excited to be able to share with you. But this is the first time I've had a conference where I've been asked to speak a session on each of my four books. Usually when I go to a conference, I'm asked to speak on the content of one of those books. And it's like asking a mother of four children to talk about her favorite child. I'm thrilled to be able to do that and am looking forward to it. But also for me, coming to Mount Hermon is special because I came here with my family when I was in the sixth grade, and we were here for 2 weeks. We were here for family camp, and we were here for the Dallas Seminary Conference. My father is a Dallas Seminary graduate, and so he was interested in that. And my parents told us, I have three brothers, and they told us that they wanted us to join them for the evening meeting. And so the first time we went to an evening meeting, they said, you know, you can do whatever you want during the day, but you don't have to come to the morning meeting, just the evening one. So we went to the first evening meeting, and we all decided we wanted to go to the other meetings because they were just so rich. And I remember, you know, as a sixth grader, that was the first time I took notes as I listened. And for a long time, I had those notes. I don't know if I have them still. We've moved so many times, and some things never showed up when we got to our next destination. But anyway, it's a very special memory for me because I think, you know, it was just the first time there was an awakening in me at a different level, a different kind of hunger, and it happened here. So anyway, I'm excited to be back. And I said earlier, I'm also thrilled to be out of the cold. And it is irritating my friends on Facebook that I'm saying things about that. But anyway, this evening I'm going to talk a little bit out of sequence of my books. I'm going to talk about Lost Women of the Bible, which is the second book that I wrote. But it's where a lot of pieces came together that frame everything else that I'm going to talk about. Several years ago, I came across the story of a young Ukrainian girl by the name of Marika. She had a sick mother, and her father was an unemployed alcoholic. And she had two younger sisters, and she knew that she needed to get a job to take care of the family because they were just falling apart. And she heard about a waitressing job in Tel Aviv. And she was a little bit uncertain about this job because she'd heard things about what had happened to young girls, but she was reassured that it was on the up and up, so she took the job. She ended up 1,000 miles away from home without her passport and in the clutches of sex traffickers. She said the first day she was forced to service 8 men, and over the next 4 months, she lost count. When I read that story, I was absolutely horrified by what was happening to this young girl. And it wasn't a fiction. It was a true story. I was shocked. I was horrified. But I didn't think it had anything to do with me or my story. I didn't realize how important Marika was to me. I was concerned about what was happening, or rather what was not happening, in my own story. I was raised in a Christian family. My father was a pastor. My mother was doing all the typical things a pastor's wife would do, and I wanted to be just like her. And I was taught by the church and taught by my family and bought into it heart and soul that as a woman, I was called to be a wife and mother. I wanted that more than anything. So it came as something of a shock to me when I graduated from college and there wasn't anyone I wanted to marry. And I didn't have a backup plan. And it was like the bottom dropped out. And I was encouraged to wait and, you know, just believe that God would bring a husband to me. And instead of the marriage that I expected, I entered a long stretch of singleness. When I finally got married, I entered a new battle, and it was the battle with infertility. And 4 years into marriage, and after several surgeries, I came out of the operating room and was brought to consciousness to be told that my hopes of ever bearing a child were gone for good. And I began to ask this question, you know, as a woman, am I missing God's call for me? Am I missing the purpose for which I was created? And I was struggling with these questions. And as I struggled, I began to look around and realize that other women were struggling about what their purpose was as a woman for all sorts of different reasons. I had three friends in Florida who woke up one morning as wives and mothers and crawled into bed that very same day as widows because of a plane crash. I looked at women's stories whose, you know, husbands left them, or women who never married, women who pursued careers, women who had physical problems, all kinds of issues that they were facing. And the same questions coming, like, what does it mean for us to follow God as women? What is our calling as women? Is God's calling for me something I can miss? Is it something I can lose? Is it something I can be cheated of? Can someone take it from me? Can I destroy it myself? These were the questions that I was asking. And the longer I asked questions, the bigger the questions got. I mean, I even looked at my own mother, and I thought, my mother, when my parents had their 65th wedding anniversary, my brothers and I did some statistics on their marriage, and we found out that they had had 32 years with a child or a young adult in their home. So for 32 years, which is a long stretch to have kids at home, my mother had one of us in the house. 32 years. Well, she's 91. That's not even half of her life. She was married for 69 years, but what about those first 19 years? You know, did she have a purpose then, or was her purpose down the road? You know, these were the kinds of questions that I was asking. And what happens, you know, after we're gone and my father dies, and is it over for her? Does she not have, is her purpose finished? You know, these were the questions that were going through my mind. And then, when 9/11 happened, the questions got bigger, because I realized I was asking for me, and I was asking for women who live in a culture that's very prosperous and we have lots of freedoms here. But what about those women? What is God's purpose for those women? Am I thinking about them? You know, the Bible is a global book. Why am I just thinking about us? Can I say the same things to them that I would say to this audience? You know, and as I looked at the landscape of the 21st century for women, I realized that the world for us is a world of extremes. We have women who live in utter powerlessness. They can't even show their faces in public. You know, they spend their lives concealed like this, or in the confines of their home. They can't go out in public without a male escort of some kind. And I read in Malala's book that it can be, even be a little boy can go with them, but there must be a male with them when they go out in public. So utter powerlessness to shape their lives and make choices for themselves and to even show their faces and have an identity in public. And then at the other end of the extreme, we have women with enormous power. You know, every year Forbes publishes the 100 most powerful women in the world. And I read that list and I'm telling you, it makes you stand taller to realize what these women are doing. And they are heads of state. They're ambassadors of their countries. You know, they're activists and they're CEOs. And it's incredible. And I'm thinking, look at the expanse of where women live, and all of us are somewhere in the middle of all of that in different seasons of life. And I want to know, does the Bible speak into the lives of every woman, no matter who she is or where she lives or what period of history in which she her story took place, what's happening in her life, what she sees when she looks in the rear view mirror? I want to know, does the Bible have a big enough message to speak into all of our lives? These are the questions that I've been wrestling with. And then as I got ready to write my fourth book, a book called Half the Sky came out. How many of you have heard of that book? How many of you have read it? You know what? There are about four or five of you here that have read it. That's a better showing than I usually get. The book Half the Sky is named after the Chinese proverb, women hold up half the sky. Nicholas Kristof and his wife, Cheryl Wuden, he's a New York Times journalist, and she's an economist. And they researched what is happening to women and girls in the world, women like Marika. And I read that book and I thought, you know what, these women aren't even on my radar. I'm not asking for them. I'm not asking what kind of message does the Bible have for a woman who's been trafficked. But the Bible speaks to all of us. This is a global book. It's a book for a broken, fallen world. And I wanted to know, what was the message that the Bible has for all of us? You know, some of you may be living lives that are pretty much the way you thought they'd play out. Some of you may be in wonderful marriages and in good financial situations and have lovely children and be able to send out the pretty Christmas card every year. But all of us are a phone call away from losing what we have, like my three friends whose husbands perished in that plane crash. And I want to have my feet planted on something that's rock solid, that's not going to collapse underneath me. And I think we all want that kind of security. And so what this did was it drove me back to the creation narrative. And this is a narrative that is so familiar to us that we sort of breeze through it without realizing that there are earth-shaking statements that are being made in this text that we need to dig into in order to find out what God's vision is for us. And so I went back to Genesis 1 and 2 because this is where God makes powerful statements about his daughters. And I had some ground rules for how I was going to study this text. And the first thing that I wanted to do was I wanted to pay attention to what God is saying. And I wanted to weigh his words. You know, he's not just saying things to be poetic or, you know, to make an interesting story. The words that he speaks are profound, and they have to do with his vision for this world that he's creating. You know, this isn't something haphazard that God is doing. This is something that's precious to him, and it's something that he's thinking about what he wants it to be like and that what he wants us to be like. And so it's one of the most neglected texts in the Bible, but it's the one we desperately need in order to find out who we are and why we're here and what our purpose is. And so I wanted to pay attention to what God says. I didn't want jokes to be part of this. You know, when we look at the creation of male and female in the Bible, we make jokes. We make jokes about men. We make jokes about men being inept and unable to feed themselves or, you know, to take care of their most basic needs, that they needed a woman to come in there and tend to all those things. And we make jokes about the woman, you know, sort of like she's a little junior assistant to, you know, a perk for the man. And we don't take this seriously. And I didn't want to do that. There's too much at stake for us. And I wanted to draw universal conclusions. I wanted to draw conclusions from the text about women that would not leave any woman or girl behind. And I found in this text that God makes three powerful statements about his daughters that I think are completely life-changing for us. The first thing that he says about us is the most important thing you can know about yourself. We've heard this text already this evening, that God said, "Let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness." So God created human beings in his own image, in the image of God. He created him, male and female. He created them. I think the ground should shake beneath us when we read those words. That God is creating us to be his image bearers. You know, it is absolutely a showstopper moment. I mean, as you read the Genesis narrative, there's this rhythm where there's a day of creation, and it describes God creating one thing, and then God looks at what he's created and he declares that it's good. And then the next day comes, and it's just this rhythm, you know. And by the time you get to day six, you know, you're sort of into this rhythm. And when God suddenly stops, and it's like we're drawn behind the scenes, and we listen, we eavesdrop to the Godhead deliberating over the creation of human beings. And God says, "Let's make these be like us." If you read what professional theologians write about being God's image bearer, you'll get a laundry list of qualities that we possess as human beings that distinguish us from the rest of creation. You know, we are capable of reason and relationships. We show love and kindness and grace and justice. That we are moral creatures, that we are spiritual beings. And these things distinguish us from plants and animals, and they do confer upon human beings a fundamental equality, dignity, and purpose. But they barely scratch the surface of what God is doing when he creates us as his image bearers. We're created to be like God. It means before God created a single human being, he had thrown open the door for a relationship with himself. You can't be like someone you don't know. And so God is making it absolutely essential for human beings to have a relationship with him, to make it our mission in life to know the God who created us, to begin to see what his character is like, and to emulate that. That we are to look at the world through God's eyes, the God who loves this world, and that we are to figure out what it is that matters most to him. What does he love? What grieves him? And we are to join his mission. You know, and we have Jesus to study, so it's a lot simpler than it was for people earlier on. It means that we speak and act on God's behalf. It means that people are supposed to find out what God is like by rubbing shoulders with us. It means that as believers, as human beings, we have the highest possible calling. You know, if you listen to the feminist message, that they'll tell you that, you know, we need to look at the men and we need to be like the men. But the Christian message, the Judeo-Christian message, is that we are called to be like God. I mean, it just leaves every other ideology and view in the dust. It means that although the heavens declare the glory of God and His character is known through the majesty of His creation, the place where He wants to see Himself reflected most clearly is in us. We are His representatives. We speak and act on His behalf. We are created to reflect who God is by how we live and how we relate to other people. And I wanted to know, when I started looking at this, how can I become a better image bearer? And I got a great lesson from Hollywood. Image Bearing 101. And in particular, from Helen Mirren. You know, when she played the queen, she was asked to be the queen's image bearer. She was asked to portray the queen. And Helen Mirren is a superbly gifted actress. And she's a Brit, so she grew up watching the Queen, seeing her all over the place. And yet that was not going to be enough for her to pull off an Oscar-winning performance. And she said, "I made the Queen my study." The Queen didn't invite her over for tea or say, "Why don't you just shadow me for a while?" She had to figure out how to do this, so she watched videos, she talked to people who knew the Queen, she read, and she observed, and everything she saw in the Queen, she practiced. She practiced how she talked, she practiced how she, what kind of gestures she used, she looked at how she dressed and how she wore her hair. She every single thing she noticed about the Queen, you know, when she put her glasses on, when she took them off, how she held her handbag. And she said the hardest thing was to figure out how the Queen walked. I guess the Queen has this odd little gait. And she said it was just hard. She couldn't quite get it. And she was out in her front garden talking to a neighbor and sort of pacing back and forth, and it came. And she won the Oscar for her performance. I mean, if you saw it, you lost track of the fact that it was a movie and thought it was a documentary, and, you know, that you were privy to the Queen and Philip in their bedroom talking. You know, it was just amazing, the performance that she did. And it's one of the hardest things any actor does, is to portray someone everybody knows. But she won the Oscar for that. And that's what we're called to do as God's image bearers. That is your first and most important calling in life, is to know the God who created you. And it is not a subject, He is not a subject you will ever master. So for all of us together and on our own, this is our goal, to study God and to practice what we see. It takes us in an utterly different direction than we would go naturally. Calls us to live vitally important lives. It means, as a human being, you cannot live an insignificant life. Utterly important. You are God's image bearer. And nothing that ever happens to you, nothing in your story, nothing in this world can ever take that away from you. Isn't that great? I mean, I think that's enough right there for all of us to go on. But there's more. So we're God's image bearers. But the second thing comes when God creates the woman. And the Lord God said, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper." It's the word, the Hebrew word, azer. "I will make an azer suitable for him." This is where the jokes begin. But I'm here to tell you there was nothing wrong with the man. The man was created at the pinnacle of God's creative work. He was a masterpiece. So God isn't looking at the man and saying, oops, you know, there's something here that's not quite right and I need to fix it by creating a woman. It's deeper than that, what God is doing. When scholars try to understand what a Hebrew word like this means, they do an inventory. And they did an inventory on the Hebrew word azer. It's usually translated in the Old Testament by the word helper. And that's where it sort of got turned into her just sort of being an assistant to the man. But when I started looking at this word, scholars had already done their little inventory, and this is what they found, that the word appears in the Old Testament 21 times. This is how it's used as a noun. And then they broke it down. It's used twice in Genesis for the woman, three times it's used for nations. And these are nations that Israel is turning to for military assistance because they're being attacked. So it's like, send your armies, we need your help. And the remaining 16 times, it's used for God as the helper of his people. Well, when they saw that, scholars said, we need to upgrade helper. And so they upgrade helper to strong helper. And when I was looking at the commentaries and at the resources on this, that's kind of where it had come. And I went and looked up all of those 21 passages, and I began to see a pattern as I looked at them, and I realized that every time the word azer appeared, it was in a military context. You know, three nations, Israel wanted their armies to come. There was a battle there that they couldn't face without extra help. And in the passages where it talked of God as the helper of his people, it would say God is our shield and defense. He's better than chariots and horses. And every text had something like that in it. And I happened to know from other things that I had studied that Proverbs 31 talked about the woman. There's all sorts of military imagery in there. She's described as a woman of valor, and she's her activity is described in very powerful ways, like she's girding her loins for battle. You know, she's seeking prey like a lioness would. You know, it's all this very strong language. You don't see it in the English translation. But there are several other places in Scripture where this kind of language is used to describe women as women of valor. And also in the New Testament, the Apostle Paul addresses men and women and says, put on the whole armor of God. You know, he's not just saying that to the men. And so I looked back at the Genesis narrative and I thought, you know what, there's military language here. There's an enemy that's getting ready to attack. It's, you know, it was the worst assault on humanity that's ever happened. The whole rest of history has played out based on that defeat. And the man and the woman are told to rule and subdue, which means there will be resistance to their efforts. This is before the fall. And the man is told to guard the garden. It's the same language that's used to describe the angel guarding the garden after they're evicted. And I concluded from that the azer is a warrior. That God created the woman, and a lot of times when we talk about this, we talk only about marriage, but it only talks about marriage at the end of the passage in application of, you know, how does this apply to marriage? But this is the creation of the woman. This is the creation. I always felt left out of this when I was single. Like, you know, this is about marriage and I'm not married, so this doesn't have to do with me. But it's about male and female. This is the creation of the woman. So it has to do with all of us. And the woman is created to join the man in this great enterprise that God is launching. And the reason that God is bringing this Azer to join the man is because, not because there's something wrong with the man, but because the battle is so great and the enterprise is so expansive. And this is the perfect team that God is assembling to do the job. I noticed as I continued to look at scripture that the inventory was off. And that the word Azer appears in those genealogies, it appears in men's names. Eliezer, Abiezer, you know, and in the Hebrew culture, you didn't give your children names that would embarrass them and get them, you know, teased by their, you know, by their friends. You gave them names to aspire to something. And even in recent years, some of you may be too young to know who this man was, but he was an Israeli hero. He was the seventh president of Israel, a military hero, a peace negotiator, a large figure on the global stage, and his name was Azer. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody was teasing this person, for this man, for what his name was. So, you know, this is a strong name that God uses to name his daughters. And it's a way that we image God. It's a way that we have of reflecting who he is. Don't you love that? I mean, I was shocked when I saw it. And so you are created to be God's image bearer, and you are created to be the Azer warrior that comes alongside the men in your story, your brothers, your colleagues, if you're married, your husband. And it's a statement in scripture that men and women need each other, and that there's something very special about what God is doing when he brings men and women together. Image bearers and Azer warriors. And the third thing is this, that when God created male and female, we read that he blessed them. Then he tells them, then he spreads this enterprise before them. He tells them to be fruitful and increase in number, to fill the earth and subdue it. And we look at these commands as very physical commands, you know, that we're supposed to have children and multiply, you know, the population, and that we're, you know, to fill the earth and to rule over creation. But it's deeper than that. You know, these are theological callings. We're not called just to have babies. We're called to multiply image bearers of the living God. It's a call to the gospel. It's a call that all of us can embrace, that we are called to be multipliers because we are bearers of the good news. It means that when God had this massive global enterprise to put together, the team he called to do the job was male and female. Wasn't a job that he called the men to do. The women were to, you know, wait behind and hope everything was going well and have a warm dinner ready. It means that he's called all of us to this. And to be called to be fruitful has to do with how we are to live fruitful, productive lives. You know, when God created, so amazing, when he created the world, it was just all raw material. And he sends human beings out with his blessing on male and female and to make something of this. You know, two stark naked human beings in a garden, you know, to figure it out. And look around us. Everything you see has been mined from the earth. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing. What God called human beings to do has occupied the human race. You know, here you are in technology world. It's amazing, you know, how God has gifted human beings with creativity and, you know, all these ambitions that we have to figure it out and to make things better and to find better solutions for the problems that we all face. And this is what he started in the beginning, only there we didn't have the fallenness that we experience now. But we are called. I mean, when you get up in the morning and, you know, take care of your family or go to work, wherever you are, whatever you do, you're doing kingdom work. You know, it isn't just the witnessing and the Bible study. It's everything. It's all of life that is under the reign of God and that has to do with the adventure that he called us to be a part of. I just love it. I mean, I just think it's so astonishing and it's such an honor, you know, that he has bestowed on us. I don't know if you've done anything with home renovations. A lot of us watch those things going on television. But anyway, if you have, you know something about load-bearing walls. You know, if you're going to take a wall out, you need to find out first if it's a load-bearing wall, because you don't want a visit from the roof, which is going to land on you if you take that wall out. And I like to think of God's strategy for creation as built upon two load-bearing walls. God's kingdom on this earth rests on two load-bearing walls. It works like this. The first load-bearing wall is the relationship between God and his image bearers. That is an absolute essential for human beings. I mean, that is our oxygen supply. It means, as I've said earlier, your first and most important calling is to know the God who made you. It means that you don't know who you are, that you don't know why you're here, that you cannot be on mission if you don't know and have a relationship with the God who created you. Absolutely, fundamentally essential. But the other load-bearing wall is the relationship between male and female. I call that the blessed alliance, which is the third thing. That this is a team that God put together. I mean, if you look at the history of the world, you have to say that the history of men and women working together is longer than women working with women or men working with men. And it's a kingdom strategy. It's not just a nice thing, you know, and some way to make babies, you know. It's more than that. There's something mysterious to this. It's a place where the image of God shines more brightly than any other place is when men and women come together to work for the kingdom of God wherever he puts us. And it's from this strong center of a relationship with God and strong relationships with our brothers that we move out to do the work that God has called us to do. And it includes everything. Nothing is left out in this. Which means that the enemy's first attack was beyond brilliant. With a single blow, the enemy brought down both load-bearing walls, the twin towers of God's creation plan, of his strategy. With that one blow, he cut off God's image bearers from their creator and divided men and women from each other. The battle of the sexes is the history of the world. I mean, think of the state of things in our world. But you know, God never gave up on his vision for this world. He never gave up on his vision for us or for what he meant to happen on this planet. And Jesus came to restore both load-bearing walls. He came to reconnect us with our Creator. He's the only way we can connect with our Creator. He is the only way that we can have a relationship with God, because He has dealt with all of the barriers of our fallenness and our sin. And I think sometimes, often, we misportray what sin is all about. You know, we think about the bad things that we do, or the bad thoughts that we have, or the good things that we didn't do. But, you know, when you read Romans 3:23, it says that all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And I think that sin fundamentally is defined by our failure to reflect who God is in the world. And that's something all of us are failing at all the time. You know, and this is what we are called to do. And Jesus is the connecting point for us with our Creator. But He also came to restore the relationship between human beings, and particularly between men and women. He came to join His richly diverse image bearers, because we are diverse in more ways than just male and female. But in all that wonderful diversity, to join us together in a way that preserves the differences, but reflects an enormous unity that only can be explained by the fact that Jesus has come. And we have a long way to go in that. He came to reconnect us with the Father. He came to join us back to one another. He came to recover God's image bearer in us and to reinvigorate His work in the world. And He came to summon His daughters to action. So, think about your own story. Think about the stories of women you know and love. Think about your daughters and your mothers and your grandmothers, and ask the question, when do we take up our calling? Our calling as God's daughters, our calling as women, when do we take it up? I think when a little girl is born, doctors ought to say, it's an azer. And little girls get it if you say, you know what, you're a warrior for Jesus. That doesn't mean we're combative, that we're going through life with our elbows out. It means we're bringing Jesus to the world, not just by the things we say, but by how we live and how we love and how we care for others. And when does our calling expire? God's image bearers never retire. His azers never retire. Upper left corner, that picture is of my mother. A year and a half ago, my father died. And I was able to tell my mother, it's not the end of you. There's another chapter that God has for you. She moved into assisted living because she can't live by herself. But she started looking around at who were her neighbors and how she could befriend them. And she has a lot of one-on-one ministry. But even for a while, until her health started giving her trouble, she led a little Bible study. It was amazing. And, you know, to think that the Lord would give her more ministry. But, you know, I had a 96-year-old friend who died last summer. And when she turned 94, she said, I'm asking God what He wants me to do with the rest of my life. And you know what? He had things for her to do. I mean, she never stopped. It was amazing. And even after she died, somebody asked her when she was you know, when she knew she was dying, you know, who's going to preach your service? She said, I am. And she did. I mean, she videoed it before, so she was still. And the thing about it was that it was mind-boggling what she said. I mean, people came away from that service so moved by what she said. So, you know, I mean, who are we going to count out in all of this? And I want to ask, how far does it reach? And I think of the women who were written up in that book, Half the Sky. You know, you can tell a woman who's been trafficked, you are God's image bearer, and that makes the evil that was done against you even more evil, because it is an assault against the character of God, against his image. And you are an Azer, and some of the women in that story, and you don't have to be a Christian to be a, women are Azers, you know, and some of those women have been, you know, they have risen up out of the ashes of stuff we, you know, it's just impossible to imagine what they've been through, and fight for others. It's extraordinary. And you can tell any woman, any time on earth, that all of these things are true of her. And she may be a wife and a mom. She may be a CEO or an ambassador. She may be an invalid. They're all true still today. Frames all of our stories and invest every single life with purpose. You know, and God is doing amazing things behind the scenes. You don't have to be somebody who's doing something public or has a big name somewhere to be kingdom strategic for what God is doing in the world. Sometimes it's somebody you would least expect who's the point person for God at this particular moment. You could be that person. No matter who we are or what season of life we're in, no matter what we see when we look in the mirror or in the rearview mirror, no matter how our stories are playing out, we are part of what God is doing in the world. We speak and act for him. Our identity and purpose are rock solid and indestructible. There's nothing that can take that away from us. And wherever we are is a front line for God's kingdom. It means we are called to others. We're called to our husbands. We're called to have their backs. We're called to be truth speakers into their lives and to speak courage to their hearts. We're called to raise our children to be image bearers of the God who made them. We're called to be lights as the in the work that we do, in the using the gifts that God has given us, and he is creative in the gifts that he gives us. It means that our lives and our identities come with kingdom responsibility. That we're responsible for how we represent God in this world. That we're responsible for how we relate to men. How we relate to our brothers in Christ. That we're responsible for what happens in God's world, that the marikas of this world are our responsibility. That we are to rise up as his daughters and engage in kingdom work. Some of you may be skeptical about this. Some of you may wonder if this is really applying to you or if there's something more important in your story, you know, but I want to challenge you, whether you're single or married, whether you're young or older, whether you're with or without kids, whether you're in a tough situation or on a smooth path at the moment, whether you are wounded by what others have done or by what you have done yourself, or what happens to you when the phone rings and you get that life-altering message. I want to challenge you to think about these things and how they frame your story. That your identity is secure, can't fall apart. That your mission is unchanged. That your life is full of purpose. I want to challenge you to put your hand in the hand of the God who made you, and Azer on in the life he has given you.